You're listening to a podcast from funnyinthemiddle.com.
Hi, we dig music, and because of this, we've kept the music in our podcast at a low background level because we believe that you should support the artist by buying their records and going to their gigs. If you want to hear the songs in full, we've made Spotify playlists of all available music featured in each episode, which you can find on funnyinthemiddle.com. You can also join in the discussion on Facebook and Twitter by searching at WeDigMusicPcast. Finally, if you dig what you're hearing, please subscribe to us on your podcast app of choice, write a review if possible, and tell all your friends that you think would enjoy it. Anyway, enough of my yakking. On with the podcast.
And welcome to We Dig Music. I'm Tracy, and with me are my co-hosts Colin.
Hello.
And Ian.
Hello.
Each episode, we take a letter of the alphabet and discuss two bands, one well-known and one lesser-known. Sometimes we like them both, sometimes we don't.
Which is normally your way of hinting that you don't like one of them.
Yep.
Or don't like both of them.
And sometimes I try and find something else altogether to talk about.
Sometimes we have to be nice about Tracy's country bollocks.
So this episode is the letter O, and we're going to be discussing Ocean Size and Ozzy Osbourne.
Yep.
Although potentially we might talk about that band he was in first.
Yes.
Very probably. So, Ian, tell us a little more about Ocean Size.
Okie dokie. An English band. I always assumed they were Scottish because of the Biffy connection.
They're from Manchester.
Yeah,
I think.
Yeah. Yeah. Proving that good music can come out of Manchester.
Joy Division are good.
Yeah, okay.
That's... The Smiths.
Yeah.
There's some good stuff from Manchester. It's just the Stone Roses aren't part of it.
No. Anything described as Madchester can suck a fuck. Anyway, yeah, so they were formed in 98. I didn't realise they would have been around that long. Mike Venett, guitar and vocals. Steve DuRose, guitar backing vocals. Richard Gambler Ingram, guitar and keyboards. Mark Heron, drums. And John Ellis, bass guitar. Although they had a different bass guitarist towards the end of their career, apparently.
The first album was a bit later than that, wasn't it? Was it quite a while before the first
album?
Yeah,
I reckon so.
I think it was about 2001, 2002. Ian's just looking through Wikipedia.
Yes,
well prepared as always.
2003 was their first studio album. Yes. They had EPs previous to that, though.
Right. Okay.
Like
yeah.
Three EPs before that.
No, that was the Beta Band. Sorry, carry on.
Pillock.
Sorry.
Nice.
Continue.
Reference.
Right, yeah, only four albums, Efflorescence, Everyone Into Position, Frames, and Self-Preserved While the Bodies Float Up. And then they split, because some of them were massive drug fiends. They were just a car crash, apparently.
Right.
Towards the end of their career. Mike Venner has done a solo album, which I really rate. Tracy probably doesn't. And he also plays him and Gambler.
Yeah,
are
two of them, yeah.
The live performance people in Biffy.
Live performance people,
yeah, they
that sounds like they're like mime artists on stage with Biffy Clyro. They're basically live guitar.
Like how
Howard Jones
used to have a mime artist.
Yeah, it was amazing when we saw them, right? Because like the staging for Biffy's last tour was fucking spectacular. It's just like squares made of LED lights getting thinner, like smaller and smaller, and like a ramp.
Okay.
And Biffy were in that bit.
Right.
The really brightly lit bit. Yes. All like, you know, obviously shirtless because they're Biffy. And
they don't own any shirts.
Shirts explode off them.
Yeah.
And the moment they walk on stage, it's just unavoidable.
Yeah.
And then like, I could see a keyboard in the side, and I was like, oh, I wonder if they're going to wheel that on later. And then a man came and he played the keyboard.
I'm like, in the dark.
Yeah, like, he wasn't not lit.
So he wasn't hidden behind amplifiers or
anything. No, he was like, he was there, but he was very much not part of it. And Mike Bennett was on the other side in exactly the same kind of scenario.
It's like when you've got a band playing on, like, Jules Holland, and the cameraman does not. There's always a band member that they completely ignore.
Yeah.
Because I'm always like, oh, I want to see what that guitarist's doing. Oh, they're not going to show him for the entire thing.
Yep.
So, but yeah, before Oceanside split up and half of them joined, let's talk about that.
Yes, let us.
So, were you a fan at the time?
I got into them because of the Tamworth Bands Forum.
Okay.
You remember the Bleater?
I do.
Yes.
That was a user on the...
Very good with his music recommendations. Yeah. At that point in time, I was like all post. At that point in time, I was mostly post-rocky and stuff like that, and I was getting more into the proggy stuff. And he's like, "Oh, you like Porcupine Tree? You probably like this. You probably like this." So I got into loads of stuff off the back of him, and yeah, I really like. I've got Frames and Efflorescence, and I really enjoyed them.
They're my two favourites of their albums, definitely.
Yeah,
they completely sort of passed me by at the time.
Yeah, they did not get any.
I remember really listening to, in fact, no, I remember putting it out on the shelf, and I think I listened to the debut album, FRS. It was when I used to work at Virgin Megastore, and it was definitely in the recommended section for absolutely ages, which means that the record company had got behind it and they paid the corporation to prominently display it in a bit of the store where, you know, they'd sort of recommended it to people. But they're exactly the kind of thing I really should have been into, particularly at that time.
Yeah.
And I mean, there were so many other at that time. There were Perfect Circle, 13th Step was out about that sort of time, Muse, Absolution, First British Sea Power record, Turbo Negro, Ask Cobra. I was listening to all of those records. I can remember buying those at the time when I worked at Virgin Megastore.
Yeah.
And they were, I can remember them all being in the same section of the shop at the same time. And I picked up all of those and I didn't pick up the Ocean Size.
Oh dear.
And it's only really the last sort of few months where we've been listening to them because we knew they were coming up in the podcast.
Yeah.
That I've gone, this was, yeah, I've missed something out here. But at the same time, some of the stuff really doesn't stick in my head much after I've listened to it.
Yeah.
Yeah,
like when it's on, you're like, oh, this is really cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, it took me a while to form the list for the playlist.
Yes.
Because I was listening through again. Yeah, I like that. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I like to list, if I like it three times on listens, then I'm like, oh, yes, going on the list.
Okay.
But yeah, just different stuff hit me from all over the album.
Yeah.
As I would say, yeah.
I mean, there's some tracks that immediately straight away you listen to, like Commemorative T-Shirt.
Commemorative 9/11 T-Shirt.
It's just called Commemorative T-Shirt on Spotify. Was it actually called 9/11? Yes. Because 9/11 is the time signature it's played in, which is where they originally got the name. So I think they called it 9/11 and then jokingly went, oh, Commemorative 9/11 T-Shirt, and then just called it Commemorative T-Shirt later on, I think.
Yeah, I guess.
Maybe. But that is a song that I get the riff in my head probably about every day at the moment.
It's quite Mogwai, isn't it? That's true.
Yeah.
That song.
I always go to A Good Friend of the Christies.
Yes, that's another.
Love that.
Same album?
Yes, I think
it is. Yeah, they're both on Frames.
Yes.
There's a really good live in the studio performance from when Frames came out of them playing the whole album on YouTube.
Oh, cool.
Definitely worth having a look at.
Yeah, I'll give that a look.
I watched sort of in preparation.
So I'd never heard of them until we came to do them on this podcast.
It's the joy of the podcast.
I was kind of hoping we were going to talk about the song from Jane's Addiction album, Nothing Shocking.
But that's not how the podcast
for 20
works.
Minutes.
Yep. But we don't just go, this is a song we're going to do.
But
surely you've learned that by now.
But apparently they are named after that song.
Yeah, well they would be.
But I don't hear any Jane's Addiction influence.
What? I do.
So I can't work out why they've called themselves Oceanside. They don't sound anything like.
Yeah, there's so much Jane's Addiction influence.
Do you think?
Definitely. Jane's Addiction were essentially a space rock band.
Mm.
You know, if you listen to things like 3 Days and Oceanside itself, they're psychedelic in the true... It actually sounds psychedelic rather than the garage rock sort of thing that Ian was saying he doesn't see anything psychedelic from.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, some of the guitar tones and that kind of thing are very Navarro in parts.
So when I was at uni, I had a 6-foot poster of Perry Farrell from Jane's Addiction.
Obviously.
At the foot of my bed wearing nothing but some kind of loincloth thing.
That sounds like Perry
and,
Farrell.
And, I'm going to let the memory of that poster sustain me through this discussion, actually.
Okay.
I only realized,
so if I'm smiling, it's...
I only actually realised relatively recently that his name is a pun for peripheral. That's not his real name. I don't know what his real name is, but his real name is not peripheral. Yeah,
no.
It's a pun.
Perry Farrell, peripheral.
Yeah. I was listening to Jane's Addiction on the way over in one of the live albums.
I've been intending to listen to them because
I was listening to Ryan Adams. Again.
What a surprise.
Yeah, I listened to the Henry and Heidi podcast about Lollapalooza, so...
Cool.
And I was like, oh, you've listened to that.
But, I mean, I did like some of it. I mean, well, like Colin said, commemorative T-shirt, I did. But
there's a big pause here.
Yeah, but...
Well, the first ones you put on that playlist was Park Cadillac and then...
Was that the really sort of metal-sounding...
I don't know, because all I wrote down is I wish we were talking about Jane's Addiction. But then the next one, Silent Transparent, was like much more melodic.
That's a beautiful song.
And it's completely different, and that's from the same album, right?
Yeah, yes. they're a prog band.
Really different.
This is what happens.
Yeah.
You're listening to too much alt country. You're confused when people use different instruments.
there's a Glockenspiel on commemorative T-shirt, actually. I liked that. I like Glockenspiel.
No omnichords or...
No omnichords or accordions, no. But no Glockenspiel, that'll do. But it's weird, though, because I don't think his voice suits the music often.
No.
His voice is sometimes it's a bit thin, and often it's just a bit rock.
He's got a very rock voice,
sure. If it was 10 years earlier, or 15 years earlier, he'd have maybe been in like a Motley Crue sort of... I think
it works better in Venart, like his solo stuff.
Right.
But I like it. I mean, what was the track you said a minute ago that you really liked?
Transparent.
Silent Transparent. There's the lyrics in that about the... ticker tape parade. His vocals are beautiful on that.
He's a really versatile singer, I think, actually. Like most prog singers tend to be the weak point of the band, I find. Like Stephen Wilson, I love everything he's done, but he is a pretty weak vocalist.
Oh, I don't think so. I love Stephen Wilson.
Like, he's got a delicate voice, but he's not like... He's no Dickinson, is he? He's no Morton Harkett.
I wouldn't want him to... No, that wouldn't fit the music as well.
I was taken aback by the fact that he's got more personality to his voice.
But I thought, when I was listening to Women Who Love Men Who Love Drugs, his voice on that, I was thinking, in the quieter bits, it kind of sounded like Chad Kroeger.
Fuck off.
Yeah.
What? No, he's not got a grungy voice.
Yeah, Chad Kroeger sounds like an electric razor.
Chad Kroeger when he does quieter bits.
And that song is fucking brilliant. Women Who Love Men Who Love Drugs.
Oh, it is.
It's probably one of my favourite.
I just thought with different vocals it would have been really, really beautiful.
Well, the first album in particular, I thought there's bits where he really does sound like Brandon Boyd from Incubus.
Yeah.
There's and the guitars are very sort of make yourself era Incubus in parts. That album's like a sort of almost direct mix of Incubus, Radiohead, Porcupine Tree, and Faith No More. And I know Incubus and Faith No More are pretty similar anyway, but. Mm.
Not, like, none of that sounds like a bad idea,
right? No.
Oh, no. I mean, there was a lovely bit at the end of that song, actually, like a really discordant effect, repeated guitar line over the top of the keyboards. A really, like, really lovely mix at the end of that. I thought that was really nice.
I think that they loop that guitar part.
Yeah.
It sounds to me like it's a loop, and they're maybe just sort of moving some of the, like, the tonal qualities of it and the effects a little bit. Because I think it's sort of played up. I mean, they could play it over and over again, but it'd be fucking boring for the guitarist because it's probably about 4 or 5 minutes of the exact same melody.
Yeah.
But it sounds like something that I think is looped. And it works really well. I mean, going back to Radiohead, there's some of the like drums and the guitar on it are very sort of OK Computer era. And there's a bit of Manson in there, as in the British
Manson.
Prog indie band.
Not
Manson.
Marilyn Manson.
Yeah.
Yes.
Or Shirley Manson.
All of whom
Charles
I like.
Manson.
Don't like him so much. Not too much of a shame that he's dead.
No.
Although he inspired some quite good music. Anyway, let's not get into that.
Yeah.
On the plus side. Sorry, Hitler, not a bad painter. No, he's terrible. No.
I really liked the song, actually, I liked most that you put on the playlist was An Old Friend of Christie's.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Super atmospheric.
That was the first one that really grabbed me. Like, I'd put it on, like, yeah, I'm going to listen to Ocean Size now.
Yeah.
And, but yeah, like, I was, the first time I properly clicked with that, I was driving down a long straight road in the mist.
Right, okay.
I was like, fuck me.
This is
creating its own music video.
That start of it, they like, just like the bass drum that just tolls.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's super
and
ominous,
the
isn't it?
The slide guitar towards the end.
Yeah, when that comes fantastic. In, it's just such a big
lift. It's got a really big build to it and really good structure. Yeah.
That's probably the most post-rock that they get, really.
Yeah,
No, it's not, is
really?
It?
Really?
Yes, because the cover version of Walking on the Air is
fair
significantly
point.
more,
which we spoke about last episode at Christmas.
Yep.
But, I mean, when I saw it on the playlist that it was going to be sort of 10 minutes long, I was thinking, no, this is going to go on. And actually, it didn't. 10 minutes didn't feel too long for it.
No, like a
I thought, oh, I'm getting the hang of this.
good prog songs don't necessarily outstay their welcome.
Mm.
Yeah.
Like, when we get onto Porcupine Tree, when you hear Arriving Somewhere But Not Here by Porcupine Tree, you'll be like, motherfucker, that song could have gone on for at least 6 more hours.
Are they like Pelican?
No. They begin with the same letter.
I know.
And they're essentially in the progressive
sphere. I just wondered if you'd put them in the same...
Pelican are...
I'd have put them as
major
post-metal.
Post-metal, but major key.
Because you recommended them to me once. And I didn't quite get them.
They're one of those bands that I've never quite gelled with.
Yeah.
Like 100%.
I've got one of their records.
Like, I like it. I know I should like it more.
Yeah.
Same with Russian Circles. I like it, but not enough to be really invested.
But I think that I'm sort of the same as that with Oceanside.
Yeah.
But no, actually, no. I like them more than I think I do, because those songs have kept coming.
Yeah,
back
like, they're one of those bands that you forget about, and then you put them on, and you're like, I fucking dig this.
Talking about forgetting about them.
Yeah.
I've seen them live.
What?
I did not realise that I had seen them live until. I'd already been listening to the records in preparation and making notes and thinking about things for this podcast.
That's fantastic.
As a complete coincidence, had looked up something about the main band that was headlining. They supported Smashing Pumpkins Nottingham Ice Arena about 10 years ago, something like that. Might be slightly longer ago than that now. And it was completely overshadowed by that particular gig, the... It's gone down notoriously as Billy Corgan stormed off the stage and they didn't come back.
Yeah.
What happened was that tour, Smashing Pumpkins, had a 10-song encore planned.
Yeah.
Which is a ridiculously long encore.
Yes.
And what had happened is the audience was so flat and unresponsive. I was sitting up on the side so I could see that nobody was getting into it at all.
Yeah.
And Smashing Pumpkins went off the stage for the end of their set, and there was applause for probably 2 seconds, and then it stopped and it was completely silent. And they were just like, fuck it, we'll go back to the tour bus then. And people were absolutely fucking livid. And I've read people on the internet writing rants going on about how Smashing Pumpkins played 4 songs, like, you know, they're only on stage for 20 minutes and then they fucked off and we paid all this money. It's bollocks. They play a really long set anyway, so they're on stage for like an hour and 45 minutes,
which is
standard, which is value for money. They then went off stage and didn't come back and do an encore. That's what an encore is for.
Yeah.
The whole point of an encore is it is an extra bit put on there. And it is I hate encores. I don't like doing them myself. When I do my own solo gigs, I always tell people, okay, this is my last song, unless you want to hear any more. And if they play, if they want more,
and that's it.
I'll play more.
It should be that way. You should never presume. You should never presume, should you? You should come back if people want you.
Alice Cooper didn't.
Yeah, well, I
no encore there.
I plan songs for it, but I don't do the whole going off stage. And if people want me to play more, I've got the songs there ready. But it's not an encore because I've not gone and come back. Yeah. There's sort of genuine encores. I remember seeing Hope of the States years ago on one of their really early tours, and they literally had not got enough material to do an encore. They played everything that they'd got. They got an amazing reception and they felt that they had to come back on.
Yeah.
They didn't really want to play one of the songs again, which is what I have seen a couple of bands do in their early days.
Yeah.
So the singer came out on his own and played a cover on his piano, just completely solo. That is genuine because they were really surprised and not expecting to have to come out and do it. When you've got it on the set list and you're playing the same set list every night, which is how I knew that, and how everybody knew that there was a 10-song encore planned. And that's why people went completely mental
but
about it.
If they're not going to be, like, you can't complain after the fact if you were stood at the front going, fuck it.
Yeah.
I can't be asked to get in.
But I think it's Nottingham Ice Arena. It's a really fucking soul.
Yeah, I've only been to one gig there and it was awful.
I saw Radiohead there and they were great, but the atmosphere was rubbish.
Yeah, I saw The Prodigy and that should have been a great gig because it's The Prodigy and
I've seen White Stripes there as well, and again the atmosphere was terrible. My sister used to work there when she was at uni, so she went to loads of gigs. And I don't know if it's because it's an ice arena and it's colder than most places and people just get lethargic and stuff.
Yes.
But it's, if I saw a tour and somebody was playing there and that was my nearest date, I'd go to the next nearest.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. I wouldn't go back there.
But it's, Oceanside were the support act and I saw the support act, but I have no memory of it whatsoever.
Wow.
Have you seen them?
No, I haven't. I'm really bummed about it.
Did you sort of get into them after they'd already finished then?
No, they'd have been doing stuff, but I wasn't into them enough.
Right, yeah, yeah.
And I didn't know anyone else that was really into them that I could go to gigs with anyway, so I just, you know.
I've just remembered who Venant's vocals remind me of, particularly on his solo album. He does sound like Bruce Dickinson.
He does. Parts. He does. Like, on Bruce Dickinson's solo stuff.
Yeah.
When he's, like, less air raid siren and more just singing, he's got that same kind of edge to his voice, which I think is why I like it, because it just ticks my Dickinson box, which is, you know,
it does what?
It ticks my Dickinson box. Do you not have a Dickinson box?
No, apparently not.
Nobody can tick it then.
It's got an old country heartbreak box.
Yes.
Would you like a slice of old country chocolate cake?
Yes, please.
It doesn't taste of anything other than tears and regret.
Brilliant. But yeah, they're one of those really weird bands because they're so good at what they do, and I really enjoy it when I'm listening to it, but I don't know how often I would just put on one of the records.
Yeah. Yeah, I listen to them a lot on the run-up and building the playlist and stuff like that, but I haven't listened to them since.
Yeah.
I couldn't remember the songs after the first time I played them, and I came back to play them last night and I was thinking, I've forgotten all of these songs.
Yeah, it's weird, isn't it? You listen to them and you enjoy them. You're like, this is fucking cool, I like it. and then it vanishes from your memory.
But I think there's two bands. I think there's this sort of rock band, and then there's more post-rock band.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
And the, as you'd guess, I prefer
the side.
I prefer the post-rock. I prefer the more melodic.
Yeah, I'm guessing all of the Venn Art stuff was you were just like, yeah, fuck this.
Because it's a bit more straightforward rock, isn't it?
It sounds to me like the guitarist from Biffy doing a solo album.
Yes,
which weirdly
it is. Yeah.
Like, there's definitely a lot of Biffy elements in that, but you know, that's not that bad. It's good Biffy, not shit Biffy.
Yeah, definitely.
So.
No, the band confused me.
That's
makes
fair.
My brain hurt. I liked it, and I don't think that I feel like I almost feel guilty that I don't like it more.
Yeah, no, I know what you mean.
It's
like,
no, you're great. Keep doing what you. Well, you can't keep doing what you're doing because you've split up. But
yeah,
keep existing what you were doing, and I'll get there later on. You know.
Yeah.
But I. They're worth persevering with, and I Frames is a great album.
Yeah.
Effloresce is a great album. The what's the black and white cover one?
That's the Self-Preserved.
Self-Preserved. That's patchier, but has got some brilliant bits on it.
Yeah.
And the second album, the yellowy cover one, is also
that's Frames, dickhead.
No, it's not. Frames is red.
Is it?
Yeah. You're...
Frames is the second album though.
Was it? I thought Frames was the third album.
Oh, yeah, you're right.
Yeah.
Everyone Into Position.
Everyone Into Position. There's a track called Music for Nurses on that I think has been on a couple of film soundtracks, and that's really good. But they are better than I Am Doing Them Justice. Otherwise, I think.
That would not be difficult.
If you like that kind of thing, sort of proggy... it's very British sounding,
yeah,
isn't it?
It is. It's very like modern prog.
Oh, I going back to the sort of British sounding kind of thing. I do, when I was looking about on YouTube for them, I actually found yesterday. There's this American documentary series called The British Invasion.
What?
I think they were trying to do another like, you know how the British Invasion was the 60s bands.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah, yeah.
With the Beatles and all the bands in their wake. I think sort of it must have been about 2003-ish. I think it was around about the sort of period where their first album came out. It looked like it's some kind of like cable, American cable TV documentary series,
yeah,
where they're just going around interviewing British bands playing like the toilet circuit and stuff like that. And there was an episode that they did on Ocean Size, and they were on that, and it was quite entertaining. But you could tell they were really, really young.
Yeah.
And not experienced yet, and we're still playing tiny venues because they're all like sort of goofing off and looking like complete dickheads on the camera and stuff. And you can tell like the novelty's still there.
Yeah.
And it was quite entertaining, but it was like, this just looks like, you know, me and my mates when there were videos of our gigs when we were about, you know, 16 and stuff like that.
Yeah, yeah.
Like the infamous Thrash for Cash movie.
Oh god, Cash movie.
But yeah, I like Ocean Size. They're definitely worth a listen.
Yeah.
Have we got anything else to say though?
Nope.
I think we should move on to speaking about Ozzy Osbourne.
Yes.
All aboard!
It's inevitable. Obviously, this is the letter O, so we're talking about Ozzy Osbourne. You can't talk about Ozzy Osbourne without talking about Black Sabbath.
Unavoidable. Unavoidable. Also, we're in Birmingham, and it's Ozzy's birthday.
It is. We're recording this on Ozzy's 69th birthday.
So happy birthday, Ozzy.
Happy birthday, Ozzy.
Happy birthday, Ozzy.
Long may you reign.
Indeed.
The Prince of Darkness.
Yes. Prince of fucking Darkness. I fucking love Black Sabbath.
Yes.
Black Sabbath, for anyone that doesn't know, are the originators of heavy metal.
Yes.
They started out in the mid to late 60s in Aston, Birmingham, about a mile away from where we're recording right now. The members of Black Sabbath are Tony Iommi on guitar, Geezer Butler on bass, Bill Ward on drums, and John Michael Osborne, also known as Ozzy, on vocals. They all grew up in the same sort of area.
Yep.
They did not particularly get on, I don't think. In the early days, basically, Ozzy had put an advert in the local music paper saying, Ozzy Zig requires gig. This was answered by the other members who needed a singer.
Yeah.
And they were like, I remember a guy called Ozzy, but he was a fucking dickhead. I hope it isn't him. He turned up, and it was him, but they then sort of went, oh, he's quite a good singer, we'll jam with him anyway.
Yeah.
So Ozzy left his life of crime. he'd quite recently done time for burglary because he had worn gloves.
But they were fingerless.
But they were fingerless gloves.
That's my favourite Ozzy story.
So yeah, left his life of crime behind, and they formed it was originally the Polka Talk Blues Band.
Wow.
Yes, they were playing sort of bluesy jazz sort of stuff.
Then they were Earth.
Then they changed their name to Earth. And then before all this had happened, Tony Iommi, who worked in the factory, had an accident with a machine, it was his last day of work in the factory. It was just like all of those films where you've got the cop on his last day of his shift.
Yeah.
He's like, it's my last day before retirement. I'm just going to have a quiet day, and then he gets shot or something. He was using this big metal press which came down on the ends of his fingers, chopped two of his fingers off. Not the whole fingers, just the tips.
Yeah.
And he was already a guitarist, and he was like, what the fuck? What's going to happen now? I can't play guitar. And then somebody showed him a Django Reinhardt record.
Yeah.
Django Reinhardt.
This dude's only got two fingers.
He was a jazz guitarist who had been in a fire and he'd lost a load of his fingers. And if you listen to his stuff, it's really complex, really technical guitar. And Tony Iommi listened to that and was like, I suppose I better get back on with it. So he made little tips of his fingers out of he melted down an old fairy liquid bottle and then little plastic fingertips with a little bit of leather put on there, which he then relearned to play guitar. I'd always thought, and the legends always seem to say, the legends, this is how fucking legendary they are, it's like they're fucking King Arthur, but the stories always say that he down-tuned his guitar so that it was easier to play. But the first two Black Sabbath records are in standard tuning.
Yeah, he used like super light strings.
He did. He used to use 8-gauge as his top E.
Yeah.
Which was, you couldn't buy guitar strings.
Yeah, I think it was a banjo string.
He used to get banjo strings to put on his guitar, which completely goes against most guitarists. Like, I want a really fat tone.
Yep.
I'm going to get the heaviest, I'm going to get some Ernie Ball skinny top heavy bottoms, 52 grade fucking low E.
And there you are, you've got the heaviest metal ever played on.
You've got Tony Iommi playing on little fucking dinky. I would snap every single one of those strings as soon as I went near it.
Yeah, without a doubt.
I mean, I break enough strings at the gauge I use, but.
You do.
But yeah, he didn't down tune at first, but then later on started down tuning the guitar, which made it even heavier. But then basically the story goes they were in their rehearsal room, which was opposite a cinema.
Yeah.
And they were talking one day, and people were all going into horror films were really popular. And it's like, people seem to really like scary movies. Why don't we write some scary music? So they wrote Black Sabbath. And I think they then changed their name after writing the song to fit the band.
Yeah, yeah. Didn't they? I'm sure they said on that documentary that they first played that in Lichfield or something.
They did. It was the Pokey Hole Blues Club in Lichfield, which is still going, but is at a different venue. But yeah, they used to play little blues and jazz clubs, and then because there was nowhere playing this kind of music that they'd invented, which was just ominous, scary sounding, slow, like dirgy metal, but it didn't have a name yet.
Yeah.
No, well, they were complete pioneers.
They were.
I mean, there was nothing else like that in, you know, sort of 1970.
No, well, I mean, you got stuff like Led Zeppelin, but they were heavy in a completely different way.
Yeah.
It was like when we were discussing in the Iron Maiden episode about whether Maiden was considered heavy because they don't sound like it to my ears because it's just fast, but it's still quite high.
Yeah.
But Black Sabbath were fucking low, deep, bassy sound.
Yeah.
You got... Black Sabbath have had a lot of lineup changes over the years.
Yes.
But the four of them is where the real magic is. Because you've got the rhythm section, you've got Bill Ward, who's a jazz... Well, I mean, they were all jazz musicians and blues musicians originally.
Yeah, yeah.
But he's a really sort of jazzy drummer. And it's almost like the interplay between him and Geezer Butler's bass is Geezer's trying to slow things down, whereas Bill Ward's trying to speed things up, and the way they sort of pull against each other gives it a really amazing groove.
Yeah,
and then
for sure.
You've got Iommi over the top with his amazing riffs, and then Ozzy on the top above that. Just one of... He's not a technically amazing singer.
No.
That
no.
must be said.
He's a characterful singer is what
yes.
he is.
he is unmistakably Ozzy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And...
He's got quite a screechy vocal.
Well, sort
largely.
Of. I think he was a bit more screechy in the solo stuff in the 80s.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's
a bit nasally.
No one sounds like Ozzy at all.
But it works so well.
It does.
But yeah, so, I mean, I truly believe that Black Sabbath are one of... the most influential bands of all time.
Yep.
They're hugely influential. I mean, I'd say almost the whole American hardcore scene is based on Black Sabbath. Oh, no, yeah, but not just metal. I mean, like, going on, like, much later than that. I mean, Greg Ginn of Black Flag cites Black Sabbath as major heroes, and he was happy that their name, in part, conjured up Black Sabbath.
Yeah. There's so many bands with black at the start of their name.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Black Keys, Black Rebel Motorcycle Club, Tracy's favourites.
I love that. So many, like three.
Yeah, I can't think of more at the moment.
Black Lips, just Black Mekons.
Yeah, they'll do.
Birmingham Band.
Yeah.
There we are. Your original point was for shit, but we got a few more in and that was good. Yes. Have you ever noticed, like, when Ozzy has... his, like, when he does solo stuff and he covers Sabbath songs, because obviously it's covered, right?
Yeah.
Every single guitarist I've seen play it, be it Zakk Wylde or that Joe Holmes he had for a bit, they always overplay the shit out of Sabbath songs, and it bugs me to...
Well, that's the difference between his solo stuff, which I do want to talk about his solo stuff as well. It's the O episode, we've got to.
I was trying to push for a little bit of a segue there.
Yeah,
you know, but
nicely done. It's a much more American style.
It is.
Because he's been living in LA, in Hollywood.
For a long time.
For a very long time, and his band, you know, a lot of his bands have been from the LA, you know, Whiskey A Go-Go sort of Sunset
it's
Strip.
It's always a real mixed bag of musicians, isn't it?
Yeah.
Like, in X Faith No More.
Yeah. Mike Borden.
Yep.
Rob Trujillo.
Alice in Chains. Mike Inez was his bass player for a bit as well.
Yeah.
Who was the guy after Randy?
Randy Rhoads.
Who was the guy after him?
I think that was Zakk Wylde.
It was Zakk Wylde.
No. There was someone else in between.
Oh, God.
Because
there was,
he had to step in after Randy Rhoads was killed.
Yes. And he died as well, I think.
Did he?
I'm sure.
His name's Steve something. Ian, get the iPad.
Yeah.
I am.
My brother was telling me about this, and he actually said that he remains his favourite Aussie guitarist.
I still really like Randy Rhoads.
Yeah.
You know, some of the stuff that... The riffs that Randy Rhoads were coming out with were great.
Yeah, Mr. Crowley.
Mr. Crowley, Bark at the Moon. The whole Bark at the Moon album's really good. But the thing with Aussie is there aren't so many consistently good albums, but there's odd singles throughout the career that are really good.
Yeah, because like you've got shit like Crazy Babies, which is appalling. So yeah, I think for every Mr. Crowley or... just Mr. Crowley for me.
Yeah.
No More Tears, actually. God damn.
Oh, No More Tears. That riff. Great.
That's Zakk Wylde, though, isn't it, I think?
Yes, it was. And so was... Perry Mason, I really like.
Perry Mason is not Zakk Wylde.
Was it not?
No, it's Joe Holmes.
Okay. Fair enough. I always thought that was Zakk.
Did we find the name
Joe
of that?
Joe Holmes on the... I'm trying to find...
Aussie solo guitarist-y thingy. But, yeah, it's so different from the Birmingham sound to the LA sound.
Yeah.
Obviously, I think the drugs were even worse when he was in LA. I think Black Sabbath they were severely off their faces most of the time.
Yeah.
You know, Volume 4, they've got Snowblind on that record, which is about cocaine, because he says, cocaine, in the chorus. But there's also, there's in the credits to Volume 4, they thank the Great Coca-Cola Company of California. Which is not even slightly subtle.
So, here we go. Former members, Brandy Rhodes.
Yeah.
Bernie Torme.
Okay.
As a guitarist.
Yeah.
Brad Gillis.
Yes.
Guitarist. Also in Night Ranger.
Right, don't know of them.
Jake E. Lee was I was thinking of.
Is it Jack E. Lee?
Jake.
Okay.
Jake E. Lee. He was in Rat.
Yes.
Steve Vai, believe it or not.
Steve Vai, really?
Yep. Wow. Alex Skolnick from Testament. Yeah. I didn't know that one. Joe Holmes, yeah.
Yeah.
He's from Dave Lee Roth's band.
Yes. Well, it's part of the LA. You know, it's all the sort of Van Halen kind of scene.
Still mentioned the one.
Jerry Cantrell.
Really?
Oh, yeah. I did not know that. He was on Undercover, apparently.
Which is a covers record, I think.
Yep. Gus G from Firewind.
Right.
Bob Daisley. Oh, he was a bass player, sorry.
Right.
But yeah, like, it's ridiculous.
Still haven't got to the
fucking
one.
Rudy Sarzo from Whitesnake.
Still haven't mentioned the one
and
that I was trying
Jeff
to think
Tate's
of.
Jeff Tate's Queensryche.
Never mind.
Have you not written down who that is in your extensive notes?
No, because we had a conversation yesterday in the pub and I've forgotten.
Geezer was in Ozzy's solo band.
Yeah, Geezer did play with him for
a bit. He was on Osmosis.
Yeah.
Mike Inez, as I said.
Yeah. But that's the thing. Both Black Sabbath and Ozzy Osbourne's solo band have had so many lineup changes.
Oh, I forgot about this one. Jason Newsted.
Yes.
Really?
Because they swapped.
Well, I was just about to say, didn't Jason Newsted join when Rob Trujillo left and joined Metallica? Yeah.
No, there's a link. Didn't Jason Newsted have some problem? What happened to his hands? And he couldn't play anymore.
Yeah, no, he's got...
arthritis?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
I think he still plays a bit, but not obviously not to the extent.
Yeah,
because he was doing his own.
I love Jason Newsted. Fucking love him.
He seems like a really good guy.
I think I've seen Ozzy play at Ozfest with Jason Newsted in the band.
Wow.
I think he was in the band that year.
Tommy Lee played on something. Roy Magora from Soulfly.
Yeah. Was it the whole Ozfest scene? I think he used to pick up musicians a little bit from that.
Yeah.
Because at Ozfest, obviously, following the success of Lollapalooza, I think it's more Sharon's idea than Ozzy's.
Yeah.
Basically, they came up with a travelling metal festival, which was basically... It pretty much defined new metal, didn't it, in the late 90s, early 2000s. You know, you'd got...
And Ozfest's still going, isn't it?
Yes, there was one... recently.
Yeah.
I don't think it travels as much now, as far as I know.
Mm.
I think it's just they do sort of one-off gigs. I think that I've got a feeling they did a cruise ship a while ago, so that actually did travel while they were playing.
Oh, that's stealing from 10,000 Tons of Metal.
Lots of people are doing it.
Yeah, there's the Blues Cruise
The Kiss Cruise.
Yes, Lee.
There was a Weezer one, which would have been good.
It's Brad Gillis is the guitarist that you're thinking of. After Randy Rhoads.
Oh, that's not the name I was thinking.
But yeah, that is the dude. So just because you were thinking of the wrong name doesn't mean
doesn't mean
I often am.
But
oh, Zach Wilde's back. Sorry, I don't fucking get Zach Wilde.
Do you not?
Sure, he's a good dude, but he is an overplaying.
Do you not like Zach Sabbath?
No. I'm not sold on anything Zach Wilde.
Because I was going off on my normal tangent research, and so I've been watching Zach Sabbath.
Which is what?
Zach Sabbath is Zach Wilde's Black Sabbath tribute band.
Okay, that makes sense.
He hasn't recorded any; it's only a
live thing.
But yeah, and he plays the hell out of Black Sabbath.
He
overplays it.
He's just a massive overplayer.
Well, Tony Iommi is. His riffs are fucking amazing, but he's quite understated. He's not a flashy guitarist.
That's it. If I was going to play a Sabbath cover, I'd be like, I'm going to play it like Tony.
Yeah.
Because he's already done it perfectly.
You need to
I love Zach Wilde.
Don't need no fucking pinch harmonic gashness
on
there.
You need a Laney amplifier. You need a SG with John Birch pickups usually. And you need a fucking Dallas Rangemaster treble booster.
Which has been modified to boost multiple...
Zach Wilde's got this thing, though, that he says any guitar can sound good if you're a good guitar player. He demonstrates it by playing Sabbath songs on a Hello Kitty guitar.
I have seen that, yeah.
It's brilliant.
See, that's the thing. He does actually seem to come across as a decent dude, but he just overplays so much. Have you seen the Zach Wilde drinking game? Obviously of no interest to you, Colin.
No.
Every time he does a pinch harmonic, you take a shot.
People would die.
Can you get through a song without dying? Probably not. Because, it literally every other note.
I was watching on YouTube. There's Nikki Sixx has got a YouTube channel.
Right.
And he interviewed Ozzy Osbourne and Zach Wilde only a couple of days ago.
Jesus, that must have been an amazing interview.
It's brilliant. The funniest thing actually is...
Aren't they all sober now?
Yes. Well,
I suspect not Zach Wilde.
No.
Because fair point. He's just a beer guy, I think.
And not Nikki Sixx either. He's actually fallen off the wagon again to some degree. He says so. But the funniest thing is as well, though, that the YouTube video... so it's them in a studio, but you're watching them as well. But they've got subtitles.
Is that
I'm wondering if it's because they thought you wouldn't be able to understand Ozzy's accent, because if you're not from Birmingham, it's hard. But the thing is, I imagine it's one of these automated things. I think you tried to do it with this podcast,
yes.
Didn't you? And it works to a degree and not others. And the weird thing
is, it didn't work to a fucking degree at all. It was terrible.
The weird thing is, it manages to work okay on the American accent, so it works for Nikki Sixx and it works for Zach Wilde, but it can't work a thing that Ozzy says. And every time he says Sharon, which he says a lot, he came up with Sean sharing. It couldn't work out anything Ozzy says. So the subtitles are hilarious.
Fantastic.
It was a really good interview, though.
There's a documentary that's just come out about called The End. Final Black Sabbath, the final in air quotes Black Sabbath gig.
You have to see
it.
It's brilliant.
It's really good.
All of the interview footage is fucking gold.
Was that the one that they had at the Electric Cinema?
Yeah, we went to see the Electric Cinema and they had a special guest, which was Tony Iommi.
Yeah.
So we were in a tiny cinema with him sitting doing a question and answer about sort of 3 metres away from where we were sitting.
Yeah, that was just like, oh my God, it's Tony Iommi.
Yes.
It's Tony Iommi.
But then there is a bit in that where Ozzy at some point goes, I don't think I've got an accent.
Yeah, it's like, I don't think I've even got an accent anymore, apart from when I'm in Birmingham and then I'm definitely a Brummie. Yeah. It's like, dude, you're a Brummie in your sleep.
he doesn't have a trace of an LA accent, I don't think.
No, not even slightly.
No.
He's still, this interview was 2 days ago, he still sounds so Brummy, it's unreal.
Which is good.
Like, most people's accent just kind of reduces when they move away, but his...
It's intensified.
Yeah. But then, good. I'm glad it has. It's like a monument to Birmingham.
Yeah.
And Birmingham needs a fucking monument to Black Sabbath.
Yes.
We've got... There's the Broad Street, there's the Walk of Fame where you've got the little star thingies.
Yeah.
Which there is one for Tony Iommi and one for Ozzy Osbourne.
We've got a statue of Tony Hancock.
Which bizarrely. that's fair enough. I can dig that. Yeah. I'm proud that Tony Hancock's from Birmingham as well.
Yeah.
But I was thinking the other day that we need a statue of Tony Iommi.
Yes.
But not I. And perhaps there's an organisation called Home of Metal. Perhaps they can sort of get in on this and help us with the campaign for this one.
Yeah, yeah.
I think they're really celebrating the fact that metal originally comes from Birmingham. Yeah. They're doing an amazing job. So, guys, help us out with this one. We need a statue of Tony Iommi in Birmingham.
Yes, 100%.
But I was initially thinking just a statue somewhere. But then I thought, what we need is a 400-foot statue of Tony Iommi with his SG, with glowing laser eyes, towering over the rotunda and the ball ring. So it can be seen from fucking Coventry.
That seems like maybe a bit of a reach.
Like, let's set up a crowdfunder.
Yeah, we want it big enough that it can be seen from fucking Manchester. So he's just
there giving the finger to Manchester.
No, he's just there with his SG playing a fucking riff, and it can be called Riffzilla.
I invented a musical genre. You invented being a cunt and trying to claim that to be a rock star. That's what Manchester gave.
I don't know. I don't think Manchester even invented that.
So
I'm fairly certain that people will be.
Oh yeah, shit. Where's Weller from?
Yeah.
Well,
it's London.
You know, Jessica Hoop. She's American. Ethereal folk singer.
Okay.
She's American, but she's lived in Manchester for the last 9 years. I saw her in Birmingham at the beginning of the week. And she said she thinks Birmingham is a lot colder and darker than Manchester, and that's why we invented heavy metal.
She said
in Manchester they only sing sad songs.
But Manchester always claimed that it's because it's so cold and dark that they invented their music.
Ah. Well, but right, Klaxon, it's my obligatory Steve Albini reference for the episode. I saw Shellac in October, and in one of the bits in between songs, he said, I love Birmingham. He said, you've always got to remember what you gave to the world.
Yeah.
Black Sabbath.
Absolutely.
Steve Albini loves Black Sabbath.
Everyone in their fucking right mind loves Black
Sabbath. Even the Cardigans have covered Black Sabbath.
I was going to say this.
Yes, their version of Iron Man is fucking phenomenal.
Three times. What else have they done? They've done a live version of Changes, but they've done Iron Man and Sabbath Bloody Sabbath, and they're both amazing.
I love their version of Iron Man. I haven't heard Sabbath
Bloody
Sabbath.
You'd like Sabbath Bloody Sabbath as well.
Any of them.
There are so many bands. Obviously, you'd imagine that metal bands would cover Sabbath. But
didn't the Flaming Lips, they did War Pigs, didn't they?
Flaming Lips did War Pigs.
That was good.
But you've also got Charles Bradley, Soul Singer.
I saw Dresden Dolls do War Pigs.
Yeah.
That was fucking phenomenal.
Charles Bradley has done the best version of Changes I've ever heard. He makes it sound like Otis Redding.
Wow.
Whereas Changes is one of the few proper Sabbath, so as in on the first 8 albums, it's one of the few songs that I really am not that keen on.
Is that the one that Ozzy did, the fuck awful version with his daughter.
Yes,
yeah, fuck that was
sake.
So bad.
Well, that was the height of the Osbournes TV show.
Yes, it was
capitalising on it.
Yeah,
and I think that's a bit more of was Sharon's idea.
And it was probably Sharon's idea. Yes,
or possibly Kelly's.
Oh, let's blame both of them.
Yes, but Ozzy, we absolve your whole sins.
Yep, just don't do it again.
You know, Sabbath Bloody Sabbath, I always thought that the song, the vocal melody of that is Freeze Wishing Well.
It's similar.
It really is.
I don't know which one came first because they're around the same.
No, I'm not sure.
I prefer Sabbath Bloody Sabbath. Wishing Well is a great track as well.
I prefer Sabbath Bloody Sabbath, yeah.
But Sabbath Bloody Sabbath is one of my favourite Black Sabbath songs because it's so diverse.
Yeah.
You've got the awesome traditional Sabbath riff at the start.
Yeah.
But then the chorus is—it's got like the acoustic guitar, sort of really melodic bit, and then at the end you've got the fucking crushing, heavy. Up until that point, there had never been anything that sounded heavier than that really crunchy riff at the end of the song.
Yeah,
and that's by that point he was down tuning, so I think he was in at least C sharp, possibly in C. He was tuned down to at that point, which is why when it gets to that sort of low heavy riff, it's got that real sort of fucking grind to it.
Yeah. Because tuning down is the way forward. Always.
It can work for some things, but it definitely helps your riffs sound fatter.
Yes, it does.
But I mean, there's so many riffs. Just all of the good riffs.
Yeah, basically everyone else, all of the stoner bands are just
definitely
ripping off Black Sabbath. Not in a bad way. It's always very respectful.
Yeah, absolutely.
But yeah. He's just done it. He's done it all.
The first six albums are absolutely essential.
Do you know, they were talking on that interview with Nikki Sixx about the recording of the early albums, and the first Sabbath album, they said, was just done on a couple of four tracks joined together. And then as they went on and got bigger budgets and more equipment, and Ozzy was saying he doesn't think that the albums were any better for having better equipment. If they'd gone back and done that first album with better equipment, it wouldn't have been a better album.
It wouldn't. The first album sounds fucking beautiful. It's an absolutely amazing album.
I would like to hear the first album done with the guitar sound he had on 13, to be honest.
Okay.
Because that's a fucking crushing guitar tone.
Right, yeah, it's good. Definitely.
All of the live stuff, you're like, fuck.
I don't really want to change the first album. I love it so much. Even Evil Woman, which is the sort of pop song on it.
Yeah.
It's great.
But by the time you get to Ozzy's solo stuff, though, it's a bit Sabbath light.
Sort of. It's not even Sabbath light. It's
It's just light.
It's
LA style glam metal. It's taken off from where Van Halen
was. And it's weird because Ozzy solo stuff sounds dated now in a way that Sabbath doesn't.
Yes, definitely. Mm. Yeah.
Because, I mean, you've got some of the Ozzy solo stuff. The No More Tears, it's fucking awful.
No, it's
80s
not.
Synth opening.
No More
Tears. Apart from the fact that it came out in the 90s.
The synth opening is not the best, but
it's
No More Tears
anyway.
Is great. That's one of my favourite Ozzy tracks.
Yeah. I like that song.
Like, I used to, every time it would come on in a club, I'd be, fuck, that riff is amazing.
Was it the synth at the start of Mr. Crowley? That's really, because it's like it's supposed to be like a church organ, but it's obviously an 80s synth.
The first time I heard that was a live version with Zakk Wylde playing, and I was like, god damn, this guitar riff is so heavy. And then I heard the recorded version, I'm like, oh.
Oh, going back to like covers, A Perfect Circle in the early days live used to do a mashup basically of Diary of a Madman, Love Song by The Cure.
Wow, that sounds
and
interesting.
It worked perfectly. It was so good. They never did a studio recording of it, so there's dodgy live bootlegs available of it, but it's worth tracking down and giving it a listen. I meant to go on a tangent a minute ago when you were talking about Nikki Sixx.
Yeah.
I met him once.
Did you?
He thought he knew me. It was brilliant. I was backstage.
Oh, you've told me this story,
I've told everyone this story, but I don't think I've told it on the podcast yet.
Go for it.
Apologies if I have.
I think you have, but just tell it anyway.
I've told the Slipknot mask story.
Ah, yes.
Was the same day, about an hour later. Backstage at Download Festival years ago, and there was the singer from him.
Willy
Wallow.
Willy Wallow.
Standing there, sort of trying to get people to notice him. And
did you know they've only just split up?
Why? Why did they not split up before they formed?
I quite like their stuff, actually, but I was just really surprised that they were like, "Yeah, we've split up now." Like
Bon Jovi,
you're
for
still
teenage
doing
rock
things.
Girls.
Fuck. But anyway, carry on.
Oh, we're gonna have to go on a further tangent now. The guy with the tattoos in Tamworth.
What, the him tattoo and the in me tattoo?
Yes, which he really hadn't thought about the combination of.
No. Both on his forearms, and when he rests his arms on things,
it says him in me.
Yeah. Yep.
Might be the message he's going for.
Yeah, maybe.
Backstage in this, Willy Wallow was standing there in a sort of rock star, everybody noticed me kind of thing. Everyone sort of walking straight past him, and then Nikki Sixx appears, walks straight over to me because he recognises me from somewhere, I don't know where, and then just has a 5-minute sort of conversation with me going, oh, how's it going? Obviously in an American accent, whatever voice that was. And I was like, oh, I'm all right, Nicky, how's it going? Yeah. And then we just sort of wandered off in opposite direction, and I still have no idea who he thought I was.
That's awesome.
Zach Wilde does the most awful impression of Ozzy. He tries to do his Bowie accents and he doesn't pull it off. It's so funny.
That sounds terrible.
I love the way Zach calls Ozzy the boss.
Well, he is his fucking boss. He's everyone's boss.
Yeah.
Well, from Tony's, he's not Tony's.
No, he's not Tony's boss.
Tony is the boss.
Tony is, and Geezer and Bill. Yeah. I do think it's a real shame that Bill wasn't with them for the final. Because the final show, the final Black Sabbath show for me, was whenever the last one that they played with Bill Ward was, which I did try and look up and couldn't find anywhere.
Yeah.
Because it's not Sabbath without Bill Ward.
No,
you've got to have
like
four of them.
Tommy Clafitos is a great drummer.
He is.
But
he's not Bill Ward. And it just doesn't seem right. And it's in the documentary, it's obviously they're putting across their side and they're saying, oh, we wish we could have had him here, but I don't think that's the full story.
Cause no, it was really,
it's
really
horrible contractual things.
Yeah,
it?
There was like lots of money and
I think his story is that they were trying to pay him less than everybody else was getting and stuff like that.
Yeah, but that seems weird because why would that be a thing?
Yeah, well, I don't know.
I mean, I think maybe there were some concerns about his fitness and stuff like that.
I believe that's the case. Because, well, before Sabbath reformed in the late 90s, he'd already had a heart attack.
Yeah.
Because he didn't... The first sort of big gigs back was the Ozfest gigs, weren't they?
Yeah.
And he didn't play, but he came out on stage at Ozfest 98 in Milton Keynes, which I was regretfully on holiday for, so I missed that gig.
I was at that.
Yeah, I thought you were. But they brought Bill Ward out on stage. I then...
Yeah, Ozzy de-backed him.
Yep, that sounds like an Ozzy thing to do.
Yep.
First time I saw Black Sabbath and Ozzy, because I hadn't seen him solo before that, was their first final gigs, which was 1999, which was The Last Supper, so December 99. So nearly 20 years ago, like about 19 years ago. And it, by that point I'd like built them up in my head that they were basically gods, and I was a bit shocked when Ozzy came out on stage and seemed so like doddery and
like I'd seen Ozzy do solo stuff before and I was like
in my head he was like ripping not just heads off bats, it was fucking heads off dragons he's
snorting lines of ants.
Yeah. Well, that was a few years earlier. That was hanging out with Motley Crue in the 80s. But, it was taking him a couple of minutes to walk across the stage and then clap and tell people to go fucking crazy. Still a brilliant gig.
Yeah.
Still really enjoyed it, but it was just the shock of how old he looked, and that was nearly 20 years ago.
Yeah, yeah. When I saw... Like, Debbie Harry looked fucking great.
Yeah.
And she's... older than Ozzy.
Still Blondie, yeah. Mm. Oh, yeah. Well, Debbie Harry was relatively old when Blondie started.
Yeah.
She was at least late 20s, early 30s, I think, whereas most of the sort of punk bands were teenagers.
Yeah.
So there's always been that, but yeah, I think she's looked after herself quite well. Whereas,
I guess she's probably had surgery as well.
Whereas Ozzy... not so much looked after himself.
No, not even. Not even.
But it's made some fucking great stories.
Yeah, yeah.
I think we talked about your favourite Ozzy story earlier. My favourite Black Sabbath story is the one where they're on tour and because of their sort of occult
fan base, God, yeah.
They're in a hotel somewhere in Los Angeles and this like bunch of like black priest type people had turned up all in robes with candles and they were standing outside their hotel room chanting, and they the band had gone back into the room and they were like, what the fuck do we do? And they were sort of panicking a bit going, what's going on? Not sure whether they were going to get sacrificed or anything like that. So they thought about it for a bit and then they walked, these guys were standing right outside their hotel room door, so they opened the door, blew the candles out and sang Happy Birthday and then shut the door again. so yeah.
Yeah. You've got to watch that documentary. There are so many amazing stories in there.
It's brilliant.
You need to watch that interview, the Nikki Sixx thing.
I will find it.
It's good.
I think my favourite Aussie quote from that one is where he's talking about, like, jet lag and stuff. And he's like, honestly, I could be just fall asleep, piss myself. People would wake me up and I'd be like, what? Jet lag?
Is it not been anywhere, Aussie?
The Nikki Sixx channel has a regular spot with guitarists doing their favourite riffs. So there's a Zakk Wylde one there, but you know, there's every guitarist.
Is that their own favourite riffs or their favourite riffs that other people have played?
Other people's.
Cool. I bet it's mostly Sabbath.
I watched part of the Zakk Wylde one and I haven't watched any of the others, but every guitarist you can think of, yeah, they're up there doing
That's
an interview
cool.
with Nikki Sixx doing My Favourite Riffs. So.
Okay,
cool. I think we've probably got to wrap it up there.
Yeah, I reckon so.
So next time we will be on the letter P, so we'll be talking about
Paradise Lost.
No, we won't.
Pelican.
No.
Periphery.
Nope.
Porcupine Tree.
Yes. We will be talking about Porcupine Tree and Primal Scream.
Primus.
Not Primus.
Why not?
Sailing the Seas of Cheese.
Far too much slap bass. Although I do quite like
But Tommy the Cat.
That is a great song. It's got Tom Waits on it, so.
Right. Has it?
Yeah.
No, I did not know that.
Or there's at least a version with Tom Waits on vocals that I've heard.
God damn, I really need to hear that. No, I don't think so.
Okay. I've definitely heard Tom Waits doing, because Tom Waits works with Brain and Larry Thingy,
Larry LaLonde.
They've been on a couple of Tom Waits albums.
Oh.
But anyway, enough Tom Waits digression. We will see you next time.
Bye.
I think we dig music. We'll see you next time.
Bye. It ticks my Dickinson box.